Have you recorded some science? Science?
No. let's record some science. You know, like how a TV tuned to a dead channel in the old analog days was the randomness was partly to do with the background microwave radiation. I wonder if we get that in the science.
You reckon people could pinpoint our locations by listening to the difference in the background radiation?
Yeah, probably.
After it's been MP3 compressed.
With that, it's time to start the podcast. This is Linux Voice Series 2, Episode 15. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this voice and also Linux-packed episode, we have news, we have finds of the fortnight, we have a halfway reminder, speak your brains.
Yeah, as it used to be known.
And possibly even a voice of the masses. Oh, it's great, this. It's have an extra week off and suddenly you forget how to do all the most basic things, like speaking English and recording sound files and switching computers on and off. And
yeah, it's my fault all week late. I'm sorry. I decided to drive to France, where they only have 2G internet, which isn't quite enough to manage the podcast recording. Almost.
Did it take you a week to drive to France?
Yeah, it did. It took, well, half a week to drive there and half a week to drive back.
Oh, wow. Has Peter Jackson contacted you about the film rights?
The road goes ever on and on.
So we don't just do this podcast, we also make a magazine which is called Linux Voice, and you can subscribe to that at shop.linuxvoice.com, or indeed buy it if you're near a WH Smith, High Street, or Travel, the other one, airports, in case you want to fly to France and save 6 days of your life. We're also in a few Sainsbury's scattered around the country, although no one seems to be quite sure where.
Maybe Mr. Sainsbury knows.
Barnes & Noble in the USA. We're all over the place, really. But right now, for the next 45-ish minutes, we're here in Studio B.
Is that the one with the Lady Madonna piano?
Look around, Graham. Can you see it?
Yeah.
That's actually responsible for the final countdown. You know, Europe's the final countdown. That tops in. You don't
this
know
is
it.
This is all gold, but without the benefit of your pretty face pointing at the piano behind you, the podcast listeners aren't going to know.
I know. I can pretend to even hold it, you know. And then...
So, is there any news?
There is news. There's only a little news this one, actually. It seems like it's been quite a quiet few weeks in the Linux world. But at number one on the news list, we have XBMC is no more. It's going away and disappearing. Or at least the name is. The project's still going under the name Kodi. With a K, yes. K-O-D-I. Yeah, XBMC, once upon a time, stood for Xbox Media Center, and it no longer runs on an Xbox, and it runs on all sorts of other things. And there was various legal issues around the name, and they didn't like the fact that you couldn't pronounce it as a word. So they've come up with Kodi, which, according to Reddit, at least, the internet hates, and it's a terrible name.
Has there ever been an according to Reddit the internet loves?
Cats.
Jennifer Lawrence, cats.
What's the justification of the name, then? Why is it named after a developer, or?
I think they just came up with a name. I don't know. Maybe they just looked around for short words that they could get the domain name to.
Could be.
I don't mind it that they've changed the name so much. I'm not sure about Kodi. I got totally used to XBMC, but then I guess people just get used to what's familiar and it's difficult to change.
Yeah. I have no problem with Kodi. I think it's all right.
Well, there's always the argument about whether a program's name should describe what it does, you know, or at least part of it. I don't... I'm sort of in the on the fence on this issue, but some people say, you know, like Firefox is a bad name because it doesn't suggest anything to do with web browsing. LibreOffice, although it's a clumsy name, at least has office in the title.
What about QTFPS GUI, Mike?
I remember that.
As long as XBMC isn't going away, as long as it's still going to be sitting on Raspberry Pi, it's plugged into the back of televisions, that's fine. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
I quite like descriptive application names, you know, something that gives some hint of what it actually does. And especially as XBMC Kodi seems to be, you know, quite widely used by people who are non-technical. I mean, there was the Kickstarter we were talking about the other day, the Raspberry Pi XBMC NASBox.
The Slice.
Yeah, that's it, the Slice. And they're able to say XBMC, and I think a lot of people understand and recognize that.
Mm. Yeah. Next up on the news, the ARM64 architecture is now a Debian port, and they'll be trying to incorporate it into the next release. ARM64 it's fairly obviously a 64-bit version of ARM, which it's relatively new. Most ARM devices are 32-bit. The one exception really is the new iPhone. There's very little hardware available for this at the moment, but it shows the ever onward march of technological progress.
How compatible is ARM 32-bit and ARM 64-bit? Because I'm casting my brain back here now to the Acorn Archimedes, which was the RISC PC was 26-bit or something, wasn't it? And then
I've no idea about the Acorn Archimedes, but ARM 64 and 32-bit, I believe, are very similar in sort of terms of compatibility to x86, 32 and 64-bit.
Okay.
Our 32-bit code does run on top of a 64-bit processor.
Oh, great.
To be honest, I'm somewhat sceptical of the need for a 64-bit ARM. If you're doing anything that needs 64-bit processing power, shouldn't you be using an x86 processor?
What about power requirements and stuff? Isn't this not good for, like, I don't know, database servers or things where you want some number crunching ability?
Yeah, you reviewed an ARM-based server thing, didn't you?
Yeah, I have looked at ARM-based servers, and again, I think the thing holds. There are cases where there's good uses for ARM servers, but they're very rare. You know, there's not many been made really, and I think the company that was making the chips for that one has stopped making them now.
No.
Well, isn't this the good thing about Debian, that they, one of the many good things about Debian, rather, that they support every architecture going?
Yeah, it's great that you can run Linux on it, and even if you can't get the hardware yet, there's still a version of Debian there waiting for some manufacturer to make it.
That sounds like a scene from Back to the Future.
So I was thinking Apocalypse Now. Debian's there, crouched in the jungle, just waiting.
Just waiting for someone to stumble into the trap.
Oh, what are we doing? Pushing ourselves up the river?
Yeah, yes, please.
Yeah, so if you really want to try and get Debian running on your new iPhone, it's slightly less impossible now. next up in the news, Fresh Meat sort of lives on. Fresh Meat was like this big, it was an aggregator of software releases. So as new software came out and you wanted to keep on top of what was the latest version, when the versions came out, Fresh Meat was the site to go to. But it shut down earlier in the year because they said they weren't getting enough visitors. It was owned by Dice.com, so it was a commercial thing rather than a community thing. But it's been reborn as FreshCode.club, or at least an equivalent of it has been recreated as FreshCode.club.
Yeah, it's Fresh Meat, and then what was it called after that? Free Code for a while.
Yes,
It was a really great resource for when you're just looking for random new software releases. I used to use it for writing FOSPix and a similarly named section at an old magazine. but yes, yeah, so I was quite
similar. Not that similar.
Not that similar. No, purely coincidentally. But yeah, it was when Free Code went down, I turned to the Arch website because they have a list of all their updated packages, and that served a kind of pretty similar effect.
Good. That's quite constantly a good discovery.
Yeah, yeah. You could, even when I wasn't using Arch, I could at least see what had been released. And, you know, Arch guys in the Arch user repository package things up in like 3 seconds from upstream. So I always knew where there was activity going on in the free software world.
I tell you what's weird. Sorry, Ben.
I bet someone's written a script now to scrape free code, fresh code, sorry, and automatically package it up for Arch.
Could be. Yeah. Just try different compilation things. Try running config and make install.
Oh, yeah. There's another sort of aggregator. It's Softpedia, and they do Linux software. And the issue I always have with them, and it was similar, I believe, with the Fresh Meat, and I think Fresh Code has the same problem, is that you can't separate minor and major releases. So you get this massive, massive stream of stuff coming through. Some of it has been, you know, a couple of bug fixes. Some of it is major releases.
On Fresh Meat, I used to subscribe to the RSS feed, and you could filter or do a search in Google Reader anyway for the major and minor releases, which is what I used to do.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I thought it must have been possible because I know I used to submit macOS releases to Fresh Meat and FreeCode, and there you had to specify whether it was a major or minor release.
Yeah, the data
macOS,
was there,
what's
yeah.
that? You've never mentioned that before, Mike.
It's languishing in development hell at the moment, anyway. It's at 4.5 beta 1 for months and months and months.
It'd be quite nice to do a game that's set in development hell. You know, lots of bits of old sequels floating about the place. You could jump between one thing and another.
Somebody did make a game developer sim, didn't they?
Yeah.
And if you'd pirated it, then you could only get so far.
Oh, yes. Because
yes.
You went bankrupt.
I remember
yeah, exactly.
that. Yes, and moving swiftly on to our penultimate piece of Linux news this fortnight. two-factor authentication has been added to the kernel source tree.
Ooh.
So previously, up until very recently, developers had SSH certificates that they used to authenticate to push code, which is pretty secure by most standards. But now there's two-factor authentication, so it means they've got the certificates and another. I just realised now I forgot to look up what the other thing is. I assume it's one of the
like a fingerprint or an iris scanner or something.
Yeah, well, it's like the ones you have at the bank where you have to enter the little code thing.
Oh, okay.
I assume I'll just Google it quickly.
So two-factor authentication then, that's something that you know and something that you have. So you know the password or the passcode or...
I think it means just two
shape
things.
To draw.
Yeah, strictly speaking, it can be any two things. Because you can get some versions as well where you type in the password, then it will text a pre-specified number.
Mm.
And you have to enter the number.
Well, if it is anything biometric, then all the kernel developers are going to be vulnerable to this because, you know, criminals are going to want to come along and chop their fingers off
they're using YubiKeys, so we're not going to enter a Demolition Man scenario where someone's walking around with Linus's eyeball on a pencil.
I can't get that out of my
Snipes.
head.
Yeah, they're little USB keys that you plug in. And once you plug them in, it appears to the computer as a keyboard and types away the extra special secret code.
Oh, yeah, there was some talk about that recently being a flaw and a problem, wasn't there? That malware in USB devices, you plug them in and they actually then claim to be a keyboard and execute commands.
Well, you can do all sorts of stuff like that with USB. I mean, USB is wildly insecure, but... Yeah, it's one of those things. If someone's got to the point where they can plug whatever they want into your computer.
That's true. You're already boned, aren't you?
They can pick up your computer and walk away with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which would be made even worse if it was made out of ARM chips because it would be smaller and lighter.
Ban these ARM chips.
We should all use big, heavy Intel chips and no one can steal.
DEC VAC stations or something.
And our final bit of news this fortnight is that Munich, we've been we've talked about before, Munich switched to Linux quite famously, saved themselves lots of money and all sorts of good stuff in the fortune in the process of doing it. And now the news has come out that certain people in the city council are considering switching back to Windows. So I'll hand over to our Munich reporter, Mike.
Yes, thanks, Ben. I'm live here at the scene. I can see the mayor out my window right now. Tensions are very high here, Ben. This story has sort of spiraled out of control in the last few days, to the point that the NeoWin website reported that the Linux migration was a disaster and the entire city is moving back to Windows. Now, like a few months ago, Graham and I went to interview the guy responsible, and there was not even the slightest inclination of any of this. What has happened is the city has got a new mayor and deputy mayor. The former is a self-proclaimed Microsoft fan.
And helped who says, Microsoft move to their new site in 2015, which is outside Munich.
Exactly, yeah. I think he says he was instrumental in getting Microsoft to move into the city, and he's a Microsoft fan. He's complained about some technical problems he had, and the deputy mayor or second mayor has also grumbled and said he wants to look into changing. Now, nothing has been put in stone whatsoever, but news sites have been reporting that's it. They're abandoning their transition. The transition has been finished. It took a long time. It took 10 years, and now the council, some people from the city council, the people that actually matter in this, have come out and said, no, we're not changing anything at the moment. They can't guarantee what will happen in the future, but they said there are no plans to switch back. One of the guys on the council said that this mayor was just expressing his irrelevant personal opinions. So it's quite different. It's obviously a clickbaity, eye-grabbing story when they say, OMG, the whole transition has failed. But it's not like that at all. It's two people at the top have grumbled that they can't use Outlook, and yeah, we'll see what happens.
That was wasn't it? Like the integration of calendar and contacts and email. Yeah. They should have installed Evolution instead of Kmail.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think Dieter Reiter, the mayor, had to wait a bit for his telephone or something. But yeah, it's all gone blown out of proportion. Now, it doesn't mean that this is the end. You know, Microsoft might put pressure on the council and stuff, but yeah, it's sort of a case of let's wait and see. It's not like they just switched yesterday and they're saying, oh, it's a stupid idea, it hasn't worked. This has taken 10 years, and as we saw, Graham, it's been by and large very successful.
He was incredibly relaxed when we went to meet him, you know, to the point that, you know, it's taken a lot of hard work, but we've got to the point where we wanted to get, you know, and it's been a huge success.
Yeah.
And the important thing was that it wasn't necessarily about Linux or about free software. It was about choosing the best option, and the best option happened to be Linux and free software. You know, and fortunately, the Munich Council, and it was the whole council that backed the plan, which is why they'd been able to do it. The whole council understood the technical subtleties of making this change. So hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, and also something I've read loads of discussions about this over the last few days on like Slashdot and Reddit and stuff. And the one thing that doesn't come up, but that Peter Hoffman told us, is that even when there are problems, it's better to pay local engineers and consultants to fix them and keep the money in Munich and in Bavaria than just send all this money to Microsoft in the States, which is already vastly rich.
It's all right. The new mayor's brought Microsoft to Munich.
Yeah.
I see, yeah. Looking at it that way, then.
You can't help wondering, though, if, you know, this was part of the arrangement. I mean, to be fair, I don't think 10,000, 15,000 council PCs running Linux is going to mean anything to Microsoft. But you just can't help wonder if this was thrown in as a kind of a pride thing or something else like that, you know, in Microsoft's move.
Who knows? Yeah, it's impossible to say at this stage. Yeah, I mean, 10,000 PCs is virtually nothing for Microsoft, but it's more the fact that it was a success story, and it might encourage other eventually, you know, there hasn't been the big flurry of migrations that we might have expected by now. But, you know, like in, I think it was in issue 7's news page, we had like 5 success stories. Yeah. Issue 7's coming out very shortly, and, you know, places switching to LibreOffice, schools, places in Spain, Switzerland, switching to Linux, saving money.
We're hopefully going to speak to the French gendarme about their movement to Linux, which will be excellent.
Awesome.
Yeah, which I think is the biggest migration project to Linux.
So yeah.
30-odd thousand machines. Ordinateurs.
Le PC. I've got another news story, actually. Because we're recording this on the Wednesday, and it was just this morning that Digya announced a license change for the next release of Qt, which is going to be 5.4. And I think this is important because I may have mentioned it before, but Digya had some proprietary modules, or they've been working on some proprietary modules to go alongside their proprietary site. Qt is the toolkit behind KDE and used by lots of open source applications. So it was owned by Trolltech, then Nokia, and then now Digya. And it's still a huge component in the KDE desktop. And the fact that part of the project run by Digya was being developed as proprietary modules, which isn't a bad thing, but it created a kind of ambiguity that I think Qt has always suffered from. You know, it's part of the reason behind GTK and all the rest of it at the beginning. But they've now said that they're going to release the entire lot under LGPL v3 from version 5.4, which will be due out soon. And that's going to include the modules that they were working on, which were and would still be proprietary under their commercial license, but it means LGPL v3 gives them the flexibility to be able to release them as open source, which is really good news. And the KD team are behind it. Aaron Sago, who I always find always willing to express his opinion, and an opinion I often agree with, says that he thinks this is a good thing. And I think it's a better thing for Qt and KDE in the future. And it lessens the ambiguity over Digya's direction with Qt. I know I keep using Qt and Qt interchangeably.
So does that mean Digya's main income source will be like support now? Or
no, I think it actually strengthens their position for producing proprietary modules and also releasing them under LGPL 3, because it puts greater restrictions on people wanting to do commercial things with them. You understand what I mean? If they want the traditional proprietary business model surrounding these modules, they may as well use the proprietary product from Digya. If they want to develop it as part of an open source application stack and release their changes for free, then they may do so as well. But it was a bit more under, it wasn't, these modules were GPL v2, so it didn't have that kind of assertion over what or what couldn't be used, how those things could be used. So they can be. So I think it's better for the future of open source, better for the future of Digya's investment in the Qt framework. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention was that we've become media partners of the SPAN conference, which is being held on October the 28th in London. And if we get a chance, one of us will try and get a go. It looks like quite a neat single-track conference where lots of people talk about the problems of scaling and big data, which sounds pretty enterprisey, but it promises to be more hands-on than that. And they got in touch with us and asked if we'd like to be a media sponsor, and it's like, why not?
Cool.
So, yeah.
We do actually have a big data tutorial in the forthcoming issue 7 of Linux Voice.
Oh, excellent.
I think it's more moderately sized data, to be honest.
No. Don't be afraid to blow your own trumpet, Ben. It's impressively large data.
Are you looking large-ish at getting into the property market, Ben?
Not at the moment.
While we're on with talk of media partners, we should really give a mention to Oxford's finest free software conference, Unconference indeed.
Oh, it's in Oxford, is it?
So, OnCamp is in Oxford, and it's the first weekend of October, and we're sponsoring it. Because you went to the last one, didn't you, Graham? And it was fantastic, yeah. Apparently. We want to be in on that OnCamp action, and if you're smart, then you should too, because it looks fantastic.
Well, we will be there, won't we? In person.
We will, yeah. At the Travel Lodge.
Yeah.
On the pull-out sofa.
Remember what we said, let's start our own magazine, we'll fly first class and do it.
No more sharing rooms. The reason why we're talking like this about Odd Camp is that there's an advert for Odd Camp in the next issue of Linux Voice that's due out in a week or two. And then none of us really noticed at the time. It doesn't really say where it is.
The most important thing is the link, isn't it? What is the link, Graham? You've got it in front of you.
The most important thing is the link, and it's ogcamp.org. So it's time for Finds of the Fortnight. I've had reminders to get that right. In fact, I've...
French peasants coming up to you. Hello! I told... pas les discoveries.
I told the wonderful people on our IRC channel that we just started recording the podcast. And if anyone wanted to mention their own finds of the fortnight, I'll read them out. And I've had a couple. And I've had one emailed to me. So this has become like a... In a very organic way, it's become like a... The listeners' finds of the fortnight. Shall I start with theirs? Hugh said we should mention the rather cool Minecraft hack, which is like a 1K hard drive. I did follow the link this morning, but I've not looked too closely at it, but it does look rather cool.
I read the description, and I still couldn't quite get my head around it, but it seems, I think it's redstone in Minecraft, acts as a sort of current carrying material. So basically you can build very, very clumsy electrical circuits. I think somebody did like a very simple 2-bit computer once.
I remember seeing that.
Or binary adder or something. And now, some guy's made a 1 kilobyte hard drive, and it looks like it's made out of millions and millions of blocks. But
it looked complicated.
You want one or two bits or bytes seems fine to me as a proof of concept, as a look what I can do. But a kilobyte, that's just insane.
I think it might, yeah.
Is that enough to store Mycos?
No.
How much storage space would you need to store Minecraft?
That's true. Create a Minecraft storing Minecraft.
Is this like you can program a game of Conway's Life in Conway's Life?
Yeah. And another one from Still Void, which is pretty good, and I didn't know this. Associative arrays in Bash has been his find. There's then some discussion about the right syntax for that. But I'll leave it at that rather than getting too technical in the podcast. But this also moved on to P. Waring saying, I found out about local variables and functions in Bash. And I didn't know. I've never really thought about it. But I didn't know you could have local variables and functions in Bash. He said it's drastically cleared up all of his code. So you may... I always use Bash scripts. Everything is global. I don't worry about it. I just make all of my variables accessible to wherever I happen to be in a script. But you can have local variables and functions, which means they're only accessible to the functions that are local to the objects that you're accessing, which is a much cleaner, much simpler way to work, and much less likely to create bugs and things like that. So they're pretty cool discoveries. I also got an email from Tim Fitzgerald, find, saying that if I didn't have a find, I should suggest Elementary OS. And indeed, there is a very recent beta version that's just been released. And in the next issue of Linux Voice, we've got a 6-page feature talking to the team behind Elementary OS, which is a beautiful looking Linux distributions, fantastic OS, and incredibly popular. That's a great discovery as well. If you haven't discovered it already, you should try it out. I don't know. I have got a couple of discoveries. My first one related to being in France last week. In a very well equipped property, there was no corkscrew, and so we arrived there late at night with a box of wine in the back of the car. Nowhere to open wine. What do you do? And then we had this kind of vague memory. I can't remember. It was a YouTube video, so all internet time on YouTube isn't wasted, that you can open a bottle of wine by putting it into the heel of a shoe and banging it against a wall. So we did this, and it works.
Well, it pops the cork out.
Yeah. It takes quite a bit of strength. and persistence.
I can't quite picture what you mean by putting the... So you put the bottom right. of the wine on the shoe.
So really, I think the shoe heel just cushions the impact so that you don't break the bottle of the wine. So yeah. you put the bottle of wine into the heel of your shoe. So it fits quite snugly in my size 11 shoes. But they're kind of, you know, they're kind of Adidas padded heel. Who actually wants something with a stronger heel, I think it would be quicker. And then you peel off the top part of the bottle, and then you just whack it horizontally against the side of a wall. I'm doing the action so that they can see it in Hangouts, but hopefully listeners get the idea. Do this. It takes about 5 minutes, 6 minutes. if you're in an old French property, part of the property will fall down. And you also have really aching arms in the morning. But it's like a miracle. First, there's a tiny few millimetres of the cork pops up and you can't believe it. You shout out to the darkness that it's working. And then when you've got like 7 millimetres, you try too early to bite it out and you can't. But you have to carry on a little bit longer and you can get the whole thing out. And I can report it works on both real cork and plastic corks too.
Does it work on screw tops?
That's the thing, yeah. We don't have the problem here in the UK with the wine we drink here.
Can you do it with beer bottles? I've always been able to push corks in when I've been in a bind. I've got a pen on top of the cork, and if you really push, it will go in.
Yeah. I thought that would have been the next step. I think I was going to go and find a DIY cabinet and get a drill or something. And the other discovery is... My other discovery is a game. And it's
Bind, Graham, find.
Oh, I'm so bad. It's good because Hugh on IRC said it's funny and it makes him laugh when I get it wrong. So at least there's some positive to all of this. My other find is a game called Fez. Now, I played this on my PlayStation Vita. It's free, and this is an advert for Sony and their proprietary consoles, but you can get it on Linux, and in fact it was part of a Humble Bundle in October or November last year, and I can't believe I missed it because it's such a brilliant game. It starts off in a very retro 2D pixelated style, beautiful graphics, beautiful characterization, and then it quickly becomes this kind of 3D puzzle game where you switch dimensions from the full frontal planar view to left, right, and rear views, which can be used in lots of inventive platformery ways. And it's such a great game. I got hooked on it and completely finished it in my time away from the internet. I really enjoyed it. So it's really a recommendation for Fez.
Actually, I'll second that. I got it in the Humble Bundle. And it is a really good game. It takes a bit of getting your head around how to...
And the problems are really tough. I mean, I've finished it, but you finish it by collecting lots of gold cubes, but you can go back in and there's loads more gold cubes than you need to finish the game, which is just about right. And some of the problems are really tricky. It's great. No. They're my finds. Anyone else?
Shall I go next? Yeah. My finds this fortnight, I've got a few. I've got a terrible internet connection. It's generally quite fast and can download stuff fine, but I have all sorts of problems uploading and stuff just keeps stalling. So like SCPs and whatever. It's an absolute nightmare. So I've written a script. It's a bash script that basically just repeatedly rsyncs it with the partial flag. Sorry, and I've sort of been fine-tuning the timeouts and the delays and everything. And it sort of works. I mean, it can still take like days to upload something that's more than a gig, which is it. But anyway, I don't really know what the find is, other than my pure frustration at Virgin Media for their terrible upload speed.
You can pause the torrents, you know.
No, then Hollywood wins.
Are you still running the Tor exit node from home?
Not from home. So yeah, it's not really a find. It's more a message to Richard Branson that if you can't get data from Gloucester to Manchester where our server is, then really you shouldn't be trying to put planes in space. Start with the little problems. Solve those ones.
You could put the data on a USB stick and give it to a Usain Bolt to run to Manchester.
Yeah. I heard a rumour that's probably rubbish that Google do that for shifting data between their data centres. Once it gets to a certain size, they just put it all in a car and drive because it's faster.
But it seems like that car or truck would be quite a useful target then for nobody gooders to get hold of loads of data.
I'd like to say they probably encrypt it, but given how the NSA managed to find out, they didn't encrypt it when transporting it between data centres anyway.
But there was a story a couple of weeks ago where somebody revealed the size of the hard drives it takes to store the entire Netflix library. And it wasn't very big. It's like the size of an old-fashioned beige PC. So it crammed 50 multi-terabyte hard drives in there with a load of cooling. But really, it wasn't that big. I think they give them to ISPs so that they can locally serve lots of Netflix data to their customers without going across the internet. But you just think about all of that content in such a small space. And yes, you can imagine that a van full with a few of those driven from, a couple of hours is going to be much quicker than doing it over the internet.
Yeah. Well, for Netflix, you probably only need a few terabytes of their most popular stuff to cut like 50 or 60% of their streaming down.
Yeah, yeah.
My second find this fortnight is we're in the process of moving house at the moment. And one of the things I came across was an old laptop. It's my girlfriend's. And she's like, all right, don't. It doesn't work. And I was like, what do you mean it doesn't work? She's like, it's just too slow to be usable. So I was like, right. Let's get this
working.
She
should have known better, really, than to say that to you.
To be honest, I think she just wanted it fixed.
Yeah, she's trolling.
it's an XP-era laptop, so I don't know, 11, 12 years old, something like that. And it wouldn't boot off USB, but it had a DVD drive. And I had the DVD from, is it the current issue of Linux Voice on sale?
Yeah.
Was it the one before?
Raspberry Pi one, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had that, and I looked at it, and it had Mint Cinnamon. I was like, oh, Mint Cinnamon's going to be a bit iffy on this. It'll work to install it, and then I'll apt-get Mate, which should run a bit better. But actually, I was really surprised that Cinnamon worked fine. I was expecting the performance to be dire. Hmm. But
how much RAM does this laptop have?
I think it has 1 gigabyte, but it might be less. I might still get Mate because I think it will be a bit better.
Yeah.
But Cinnamon actually worked really well. So my find there is that Cinnamon's not as slow as I thought it was.
1 gig of RAM, though, that's not a paltry amount. That's not...
It isn't, Grandad, you're right.
That's no. Like a... That's like 1,000 of the Minecraft hard drives.
No, it's more than 1,000.
Let me tell you how much I paid for my first RAM expansion.
Of course.
My Amiga, it cost £120 for 512K.
This is when pounds were worth pounds, before they decimalised.
And 512K was 512K, damn it. It wasn't 512.
Before Pope Gregory stole those days of my life for Easter. It's not an unreasonably small amount of RAM. It isn't.
Now, to be honest, I was expecting it not to be the RAM slowing it down, but the graphics. Because I remember back in the early days, Cinnamon just ground to a halt if it didn't have decent graphics acceleration. But it's evidently got a lot better. My final discovery, I've just discovered this as I was waiting for Mr. Gregory to sort his audio recording out.
Sorry about that.
That's right. I don't even know how you pronounce it, VisuAlgo. It's basically a visualization of some algorithms. It's on a website that's sort of quite a long URL, so I won't give it here. But it's from a university, so it's mostly sort of academic algorithms like graph traversing and whatnot. But it's quite good. They've got a nice little interaction that it's, and you can sort of load it with random data and see how it performs all the different processes. So if you're a current or former computer science student who never quite got your head around algorithms, it's nice to see them all work and what's supposed to happen. And yeah, we'll put the URL in the show notes. But those are my finds.
Cool. Thanks, Ben.
Shall I go?
Please, Mike. It would be brilliant. Everything is awesome, as the Lego movie says.
Except my internet upload speeds.
When we work as a team, everything is awesome. Sorry.
Left a lasting impression, clearly, this film.
Yeah.
I've discovered two websites, and I've also found two websites this episode.
Four, or is that two?
Yeah, is it the same two or are they different?
The first one is cronchecker.net, and this is it's basically just a form where you can paste in entries from your cron tab and it will explain what they do. Now, you know, seasoned Linux and Unix administrators know their way around a cron tab, but for some people it all looks a bit like random gobbledygook with like slashes, numbers, asterisks everywhere. So if you're unsure exactly what a cron job is doing, you just paste it in and then it writes it out in human readable language, which is pretty cool. And the other website I found is hnode.org. And the description is, the HNode project aims for the construction of a hardware database in order to identify what devices work with a fully free operating system. So basically, it's a collection of information to say, this hardware works with completely free GNU/Linux distributions. So those ones with no binary blobs in or proprietary drivers or anything like that. We're talking like Triskwell and stuff. So if you want your computing to be ultra mega pure, super free, sort of like Stallman does it, then this is a good place to start.
Ooh, we should build one.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think I'd quite like to get hold of one of these ultra-free laptops. I think the Free Software Foundation or the GNU project itself recently blessed one, didn't they? Did you mention it, Ben? Was it a ThinkPad?
I think it's an old HP. They've been refurbished by Glug.
That was it, yeah.
And I'll just quickly Google it now.
Yeah, it was refurbished laptops from a certain brand, a certain model number, but they'd reflash the BIOS to use, I don't know, Open, whatever it's called. But yeah, basically from top to bottom, from start to the desktop, everything was 100% free software.
Yeah, no, really cheap as well. It's the ThinkPad X60s from Lenovo.
Oh, okay.
And they start at under £200 for £198. I don't know where they got them from. I guess they probably just got a job lot from some corporation.
Business.
Had a clear out.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
So they're not going to be lightning fast. They're pretty old.
I'd be quite interested in getting hold of one to review. If listeners are interested in reading about that in the magazine, then let us know in the comments and I'll try and get hold of one.
That includes shipping as well, at £198. And they might even run Cinnamon.
Yeah, seems it.
So, they use LibreBoot.
Right.
Web 2, and then boot into Triskel.
Okay. The current Triskel release is a bit old, I think, but I'm sure they're working on Triskel 7 now. Anyway, those are my finds, all nicely wrapped up.
Thanks, Mike. That leaves the moustache.
Is that going to be the name of this podcast?
Oh yeah, sorry Ben, I forgot about yours.
Mine's nowhere near as impressive as Andrew's. And mine still has a vague attempt at a beard attached to it as well.
No, I thought, you know, you can't really shave a beard off without leaving a moustache for a few hours. It's against the law.
Should we retake our photos for the front of the magazine now?
Oh, yeah. We might get some half-decent ones this time. We really should get some decent photographs for the front of the magazine. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Finds. I found a thing that I found before, to be honest, so I feel a little bit lazy, but it's Crunchbang. And it's led me to another find. So in a virtuous cycle of green shoots of recovery, wealth cascading down the generations, that sort of type thing, I've found some goodness. So I've been trying to use UNET booting to create a bootable USB stick with... I first tried it with Ubuntu, then with Mint, then with Tails. None of these worked. Got just a bit annoyed, and it's not really a priority. I mean, my laptop is working fine with Mint. It's just I'm just a bit sick of it, I don't get to use Linux all that often now that I'm, you know, busy doing VAT returns and other things that take about a million years. So I thought I'll get a more Linuxy Linux, so that when I do use Linux, I'm not just using something that I know. You know, you're nodding. You understand this, don't you, Graham?
I do understand. So, yeah,
like,
yeah.
So I was going to go for like Crunchbang, I was thinking, and Manjaro has been recommended as well. And in the Manjaro, in the Crunchbang, on the downloads page, there's instructions for using the DD command to transfer it to a USB stick, which is exactly where the instructions for using DD should be, right on the download page. And all the other things that I've tried, I don't know, this it just left me to Google. And I can put stuff into Google. I've done it once or twice before, but it's just, I don't know, it exemplifies the thoughtfulness that's gone into Crunchbang and the really helpful community that's there, that the advice is just where you need it. And then, you know, Ben informs me that the reason that Tails wouldn't work for me is that it needs separate DD instructions. Is that right?
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure on this, but Tails has some security stuff built into it to make sure that it's not tampered with, which is one of the reasons why you'll very rarely see it on magazine cover disks, or at least the actual as part of the multi-boot. It gets a bit tied up with the security thing.
Right.
So I suspect UNET booting was mangling it, just sort of shifting some bits around, and when it did its security checks, it may well have got upset with that.
Yeah. Well, once I plugged it in and then it booted up to Mint, it realised that, or it recognised that there was something Tails on there. It just wasn't going to put the boot prompt. But that does sort of irk me slightly, because Tails is supposed to be an easy way to get Tor and the other security stuff. For relatively noob type people.
They do have their own tool to build bootable USB sticks, although I've never actually used it myself.
Well, if they took a leaf out of the Crunchbang book, then the instructions to do that would be on the download page. Anyway, there goes my life as a investigative whistleblowing journalist.
The New York Times and The Guardian both have drop boxes now that you can use for privacy documents, for all those leaked documents you want to share.
But use Dropbox for that.
Don't use Dropbox for that. Yeah, it goes straight to Condoleezza Rice.
You need to be on a tour to use those, though, don't you?
Do you?
They're onion addresses.
Did you see, maybe no one's interested, but the Aphex Twin?
I know what you're going to say. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, man, the Aphex Twin.
There now follows a section about synths. move the little slider forward by about 4 minutes. It's
the first Aphex Twin album in many, many years, and he announces it on tour. There's a geeky relationship there.
That is quite cool.
Didn't he also announce it by flying a blimp over London? Yeah.
or the Warp marketing machine, who've done a very good job recently. But and I think, yeah, the Boards of Canada album that came out last year had a very similar kind of viral marketing campaign that worked well.
What if the blimp going over London was to intercept the Wi-Fi signals of everyone logging in to tour to find it out?
Excellent. That was one of the longest finds of a fortnight ever. Which is good, because it's been 3 weeks.
So it's time for the halfway reminder then, isn't it? How long have we been recording for?
It says 54 minutes.
Oh, crikey. Well, it's time for the almost finished reminder. Still to come, we've got a neuron to vocalise, is that right?
I think we have a couple of neurons, actually. I'm just grabbing them now.
And there's a voice of the masses, but we're really just going to have to elide that, pracy it to a whisper of the people.
Okay, so all this fun and games brings us on to vocalise your neurons. And let's try and go through them pretty quickly. Rami van Elst says, what is the best way to send some money to support you guys and Linux Voice without needing anything in return? Should I take a digital subscription next to my paper one, or is there just a PayPal address? Well, you can indeed PayPal money to us. You could send money to Mike, PayPal it to mike@linuxvoice.com. But I still plan to get some branded Linux Voice beer mugs onto our shop at some point. So
We must do it. We must. Really have it on my list of things to do for Old Camp as well.
Same here,
Get some material together.
Yeah. Maybe T-shirts and stuff like that. And then people can pay what they want. You know, there can be a base price. But, you know, and people know that they're contributing back to free software as well.
We pay PayPal just as much as everyone. It's just that our bank hasn't given us any other option. They won't allow us to take payments in any other way.
I hate PayPal more.
Yeah, Andrew's allowed to hate it a little bit more.
Yes, I mean, for anybody listening who isn't a subscriber to Linux Voice, you can take out a subscription via bank transfer. So email me, mike@linuxvoice.com, for details. Currently, our shop. Oh. Yeah.
Can we do Bitcoin as well in the same way?
I don't know.
I'll email you. You look up, or email me. I'll look up the current exchange rate and say this many Bitcoins, this address.
Do you have a Bitcoin wallet then?
I can make one.
Oh, great. Yeah, Ben. Yeah, if you want to pay with Bitcoin, email ben@linuxvoice.com.
What was the Bitcoin pay system that everybody uses?
Coinbase.
Coinbase is a general exchange. There's BitPay, which we could use, which would sort of take the hassle out of it. We'd set it in this many pounds.
Yeah, I think I was thinking of BitPay. Yeah.
Yeah, and it would transfer it straight to us. We can do that. The only thing we need to get around, which we need to sort out anyway, is SSL on the website. Mm. But once that's sorted, it just drops in and works.
There's actually a find that I forgot to mention. I was in a pub, a sort of bar, the other day in Munich, and they accepted payments in Bitcoin, which is pretty cool. It's the first time I've seen that in a pub. Anyway, moving on to... let me try and find a relatively short vocalise your neurons.
How many have you had?
Well, there are three, but I'm just trying to get little sections of them so we don't just read out for hours and hours. Michael Davis says, not sure if this has been mentioned before, but I'm confused why so many of us who feel that it is crucial to use open source, often community-driven operating systems and desktop software, don't have the similar preference when it comes to social networks. And he gives some examples like that you get from open source and free software, better privacy, more transparent and stuff. Well, I think the problem is just a critical mass, isn't it? I'm no fan of Facebook or Mark Zuckerberg, but I use it just because pretty much everybody I know is on Facebook. And if I were to leave it, I'd actually miss out on various social events, things like that. You can say to people, oh, well, just email me when something happens. But I mean, there are free, as in... speech social networks, aren't there? There's pump.io, for instance, and there was what was the Twitter one called?
Identica.
Diaspora
as well. And I think technically some of these systems might have been fantastic, but again, you know, you've got to get everybody to move around the same time.
I think this is a huge problem, and I agree with you. The critical mass in terms of it becoming a social network is really important. But I don't use social networking particularly. But what I do use in Google Plus is I use it to share family photos and stuff like that. And I'd simply love if there was an open source equivalent to something like that. Some simple service where I can drop stuff from my phone without having to think about it. And people who are following that particular private thread or whatever get updates, and it all happens transparently. And I'd love it if someone could recommend me an open source equivalent, because I don't know of one.
For me, with things like social networking, it's not necessarily the open source or closed source that annoys me. It's the fact it's a lack of federation. So that even if Facebook was open source, they'd still hold on to all your data. I couldn't set up my own Facebook server to link into it. And for me, it's really bugging me with communication at the moment, like IP messaging. And because you can use like WhatsApp and that to sort of send, but you're tied into the network and all your messages are tied into their network. And there have been, and you could use something like Jabber. And I think Moxie Marlin Spike's one allowed federation, which name is it? Text Secure?
Yes.
I think that allows federation.
Isn't that what Pump.io is there for? It's not there as a service per se, but to allow people to run their own federated servers doing whatever they want to do. But it just hasn't quite, there aren't any other services effectively built on it.
Yeah. And there's one, it's a similar thing, this, but sort of closed source, open source thing that sort of reflects in some ways the sort of ridiculousness of the moves I take. But I was getting a new computer about 6 months ago now, and I thought I wanted to be able to run an open source graphics driver reasonably well. So I got it with, it's got a decent Intel internal graphics, which run open source kernel stack drivers. But I use it to run closed source games. And in many ways, it's that sort of thing that I want the sort of core, the main part of it to be open source, but little bits around it, I'm not as, because I guess it's partly because I don't use social networks that much. I just sort of use it occasionally to mess on. It's not a core of my communications tool. It's just a sort of little addendum that I stick on the side occasionally.
Shall I go on to the final neuron?
Yeah.
I'll tell us yes. I can't see the screen because I'm reading them out.
Yes.
So.
Sorry, we're all nodding.
Neurons.
Yeah. So the final one is from Brad Whitfield, who says, on a recent episode, you were discussing Red Hat's support for CentOS. The general consensus amongst the various people that I talk to and the podcast that I listen to seems to be that it doesn't make much sense for Red Hat to do this. I thought that it did, but I had a hard time trying to articulate why. Well, recently, I spoke to a Red Hat architect and discussed the topic with him. And he put it in this perspective. Many startups are using Linux for their hosting, and many of them can't afford a support subscription. Because of this, a lot of them will go with the free solutions that they can get support for later, such as Ubuntu. Well, since, in my opinion, Ubuntu isn't really all that great for hosting when compared to Red Hat, if startups see that CentOS is an official Red Hat project now, they are more likely to go with CentOS, knowing that they can more easily migrate to Red Hat later. I could go on a while why Red Hat is better for this than Ubuntu, but basically it's the 13 years of support with API guarantee versus 5 years of updates. Thanks for that, Brad. I think that does sum up quite well why Red Hat did what it did. And a lot of people have struggled to get their heads around the fact that Red Hat joins up with a project that is offering its product for free and then encourages it to keep on making this product for free. But I think Red Hat gets open source pretty well.
I think I was the person who sort of found the decision most confusing about how it works. And it wasn't that they encourage people to use CentOS. I completely understand the point he's getting. What I don't understand is why bother with CentOS in that scenario? Why not just make Red Hat free and charge for support? Effectively what you're doing.
Yeah.
All you're doing is saying, this is the free version, we call it CentOS. This is an identical version made by the same corporation, we call it Red Hat.
So they could have just done like RHEL Community Edition, or just given it that
exactly.
name or something, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, maybe there's a couple of different repositories for the main one that has, I don't know if they have any magic sauce that goes into those. But if you don't pay for support, you don't get support. If you pay for support, you get the Red Hat support, which is what you're paying for anyway.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Unless it was a case of Red Hat just wanted to have such a clear distinction between the products so that people wouldn't end up phoning up and saying, oh, I got your Red Hat and it ain't working. But I don't know if anybody from Red Hat is listening. Let us know.
But surely, in that case, all it takes is a sed script to run and replace Red Hat with CentOS.
Well, presumably, yeah.
The whole purpose of CentOS was there because Red Hat made it hard. if Red Hat don't want to make it hard, then, you know.
True.
This is anyway, exactly the same conversation we had, isn't it?
Yeah. Those are the neurons. If anybody wants to have their neurons vocalize in an upcoming episode of this lovely podcast, then email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
Like an off-the-rails mining cart running underneath a temple with an archaeologist in it clutching the Shankara stones. That brings us hurtling towards Voice of the Masses.
So you've been watching the Indiana Jones reruns as well?
I've not. It's just in my head on a loop perpetually because I watched them too many times as a child. So I'm just scarred now. But not the Crystal Skull one. Not the Crystal Skull one.
Well, the Aliens one. Is that the one?
That's the one, yeah. That's the one. Why? Why do it? Why couldn't they not just have taken The Last Crusade literally and figuratively and made it the last one? Not just about the Crusades, just the last film. That wasn't the question we asked. Instead, what we asked was, what is your number one reason for using Linux? We got many, many replies, 60-odd replies, and we've gibbered on for far too long.
It's been good. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I say gibber on in a nice way. So there'll just be time for a few choice vocalizations in a second. But first of all, I did a keyword search throughout the document, and you know, I've got 1, 2, 3, I've got 4 terms that kept popping up, or that you would expect to keep popping up. So the first word I looked for is choice. Now bear in mind, we've already answered this question. Is Linux about choice? No.
It was this Graham Morrison wrong, wasn't it? That question.
So throughout these 60, I think it was 69 comments, the word choice popped up 4 times. The idea of something being virus-free or not suffering from viruses popped up 10 times. Community also popped up 10 times. But at number one, with 34 mentions, can anybody guess the number one reason for using Linux?
Freedom.
Any advance on freedom?
Fun.
Microsoft.
Mike's right, it's freedom. Of course it's freedom. Of course it's freedom. Why would it not be? It's fantastic.
That's great. That's a fantastic result, actually, when you put it like that.
Yeah. Ben, is this you, Ben? Ben says...
Me? No, I haven't replied to it.
Okay. This is on the subject of freedom. Ben, not this Ben, an unofficial Ben, says... As Bruce Lee said, ask not for an easy operating system, but for the command line to overcome a difficult one. If I may also quote Marcus Aurelius.
Excellent.
Live a free life. If there are others in your life, and they are just, then they will value your choice to be free. If they are unjust, call them trolls and have nothing to do with them. If you have no one else, then one day you will die, and at least you will have died free, unchained by vendor lock-in and spyware.
Excellent.
That's the director's cut of Gladiator.
Oh, that is brilliant. Let's hope there's no sequel.
Yeah, free. Tsiolkovsky says, because it's free as in freedom and also technically superior to any other OS, and there's KDE Plasma Desktop. A few people said just the fact that it works. Jack says, bash and yum. Just lets me get working. I can do 90% of my tasks on a command prompt. Richard Delaney, sick of freeware software on Windows, which left your PC virus-ridden. Performance, the elitism of Linux. Nothing makes people say wow more than when you open a black terminal window and start typing commands.
That is true, actually.
It is true.
I quite enjoy having Linux running in an airport or something.
It is quite lethal. Fuzzy Teeth, freedom is paramount.
It's Linux.
Quidnunc says freedom. We've pretty much covered the freedom angle by saying how many people like it. Stephen Wheeler. I'm sorry to see that software freedom is not a higher priority in the comments so far. To be fair, it is the highest priority. It's certainly my number one version for using Linux. I would like to put forward the view that Linux is a stable, secure, and flexible operating system because of the free software culture that nurtured it. I think that's pretty right. Simon Redmond says, in a word, security. That makes me think of The Graduate when he's, when there's all those blokes coming up to Dustin Hoffman saying, two words, Benjamin, plastics. No, okay.
It's been a while since I saw it.
Yeah. Xanadu says, Xanadu says, in a nutshell, the software tools for completing a huge range of tasks are just an apt get away. A revolution from my days of using a glut of Windows shareware and trialware. That's true, actually. Whenever I go back to using OS X or Windows.
Or Android or something like that.
Or Android.
Know.
Having to do everything through the Play Store and Android. I don't really... I don't understand it as much as... I mean, that's why I wanted to stick with Crunchbang because of because it's Debian-based and so you can just apt-get things.
I was chatting to a school friend of mine who's a Windows developer, and we're just talking about something I was having trouble with, and I was like, I just whipped up a developer. I just needed a web server and database. I just had got Apache in MySQL. And it's like, that must have taken a while. And I was like, no, apt-get install Apache space MySQL.
What about the license, Ben?
Exactly. What about the license?
Let's leave the last two comments to Les Pounder, who says the fact that I can use Linux, this is the reason for using Linux, is the fact that he can use it on a range of devices or with varying scales, such as the Vocor router, which is a, judging by the URL, it's a coin-sized router, Linux computer with Wi-Fi, the Raspberry Pi, and huge hulking data centers. That comes back to the 64-bit ARM chip. It may not be all that useful at the moment, but somebody out there will find a use for it, and as soon as they do, the first operating system they'll try will be Linux. And finally, Maurice George says, Linux can't be infiltrated by the NSA, CIA, FBI, MI5, GCHQ, or Tesco.
Because we've got two-factor authentication now.
Yeah.
So there, Tesco.
Everything is awesome.
I think that should really be the end of Voice of the Masses. Yeah. Because we've overrun so massively. With 69 comments, there is no way that you can adequately pre-see them. So I do, if you've got, 25 hot minutes to kill, go to linuxvoice.com and read them all for yourself, because there are great things about Linux that you just forget because you take it for granted. And then when you read that somebody else, that's their main reason for using Linux, it makes you think again and just realize what a golden age this is. Is that the end?
I reckon that's the end.
I've got one more thing.
Brilliant. Oh.
It's like the olden days.
One more thing. Just this very morning, we've been putting up issue 7 for subscribers, and it now comes with an EPUB for your e-readers and whatnot, which makes it nicer to read than PDFs on smaller screens. So if you've got a tablet, or if you feel compelled to read a magazine on your phone, this is the version. But we're still sort of testing out our process of making them. So if you do have any issues, drop me an email and we'll let me know what device you're having issues with, and hopefully we'll try and get it sorted for future versions.
Have you got an Android app you'd recommend, Ben, for reading an EPUB?
To be honest, I've been trying out a few. None of them have really stood out.
No, I haven't found one that I really like. Not one that works as well as like the Kindle app, for example, which I like.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't read EPUBs that much. This is it's quite new to me. So, also, if you've got any recommendations for e-reading apps, let us know.
Maybe we should do that in a future issue. Well, that's brilliant. I really enjoyed that podcast.
Yeah.
thanks. Thanks, everyone. And hopefully we'll be back in 2 weeks to do it all again.
Hooray!
Deadline week. I can see that happening.
We've gone wrong.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay. Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.